Hi, Kojo Namdi here. On Monday, October 18th, the 1A host Jen White and I hosted a call-in special about the Virginia elections. In an election that's seen as the bellwether for the 2022 midterms, the governor's race is still too close to call. We wanted to know what was on the minds of voters across the Commonwealth. What was driving them to vote or why they were not voting? Who do they think should be the next governor? And what thoughts do they have about the political direction of the Commonwealth? This is Your Turn, Virginia Votes from WAMU. From WAMU in Washington, welcome to Your Turn, Virginia Votes. I'm Kojo Namdi, host of the Politics Hour on WAMU.
And I'm Jen White, host of 1A. We're just 2 weeks away from Election Day in Virginia, where early voting is already underway. The governor's race between Republican Glenn Youngkin and Democrat Terry McAuliffe is too close to call, and it's being watched not just in Virginia, but nationally, as one of just two statewide off-year elections. It's a snapshot of this political moment, and often seen as a bellwether for what's to come in the 2022 midterms.
Indeed, the governor's race, as well as the down-ballot races of Lieutenant Governor and Attorney General, have more of a national feel than ever. So we want to hear from you, the voters in Virginia, about what's on your mind as you vote in this election.
Who do you want to be the next governor, and what should their priorities be? Are there any issues in particular that are getting you out to vote?
And we have two people with us to guide our conversation today. Joining us, Eva McKend is a national politics reporter for CNN. Eva, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me on the special.
And Greg Schneider is a reporter for the Washington Post covering Virginia. Greg, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Kojo. It's good to be here.
Greg, I'll begin with you. Can you remind us what races are on the ballot this year? Or it might be easier to remind us about what races are not on the ballot. Because only, as I understand it, only the Virginia Senate is not on the ballot. Is that correct?
Well, that's right. Yeah, this is governor, lieutenant governor, and attorney general, which, of course, are statewide elections. And then all 100 houses in the seats in the House of Delegates are on the ballot. They come up every 2 years, and the Senate seats are every 4 years.
And there's a bunch of local elections, too, correct?
That's right, local elections. But of course, you know, what I should have said with the House race is the control of the House of Delegates is at stake in this election. A lot of the top line discussion has been about the governor's race, but Democrats have had control of the House for just 2 years now after about 20 years of Republican control. So that's as significant, really, statewide as the governor's race, because it has such a big impact on what gets done or what's likely to get done.
Now, Eva, the Virginia governor's race will be important to millions in Virginia, but how closely is that race in particular being watched by the White House?
It's of great concern nationally and to the White House because this is the first competitive election since President Biden came to office. This is the only indicator that really that the White House is able to take in terms of the pulse of the nation. So there are a lot of eyes on this race and a lot of concern for what happens in Virginia. President Biden coming back to campaign for Terry McAuliffe, the Democratic nominee, again, Kamala Harris, Vice President Harris as well. So they are very invested in this.
Now, Greg, it feels like just yesterday that we were talking about a blue wave in Virginia. Give us a brief history of the past few years in the state to set the stage for where we are now.
Sure. Virginia had been mostly under, the legislature had been mostly under Republican control, as I said, for a generation. And then when Donald Trump was elected president in 2016, things started to shift in Virginia, or maybe they started to accelerate. Virginia's been changing for years demographically, slowly, bit by bit, becoming a more blue-tinted state, although it was kind of assumed it was a purple state. But in 2016, it was the only state in the former Confederacy that went for Hillary Clinton by about 6 points over Donald Trump. And then the following year, when Ralph Northam ran for governor against Ed Gillespie, he won by about 9 points. And then in 2020, last year, President Biden took Virginia by about 10 points. So that Democratic edge has appeared to be growing for all of the past 4 years of the Trump administration. And so that's why what's interesting now is to see, with Trump not in the White House anymore, you know, he was very unpopular broadly across Virginia, whether that changes what the likely outcome might be for these statewide races.
Well, I'm glad you used the term tent, because the term we've been using around here has been waived for a while. Your analogy is a little bit different. Allow me to go to the phones. Here's Ernest in Annandale. Ernest, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi there. I would just like to say that I turned 18 recently, and this was my first year voting, so that was pretty exciting.
And do you intend to reveal who you plan on voting for in any of the races?
I voted all blue for all of mine.
Why do you find it so exciting?
Because, I mean, I get to, like, influence how the next few years are going to work. I mean, sure, I may just be one person, but even one vote could, like, change the entire thing.
So that's exciting for you, and this is your first time. So congratulations, Ernest. Have you voted yet?
Yeah, I voted a few weeks ago.
Yeah, that's one of the features of Virginia elections today. Thank you very much for sharing your thoughts with us.
Eva, what are the polls looking like at this point? This is a pretty tight race, right?
It is. It's incredibly close. You know, it's so many polls have Terry McAuliffe, the Democratic nominee, and Glenn Youngkin, the Republican nominee, within 3 points. And that is within the margin of error. So it's very, very difficult to really know how this is going to end up. I will say, I want to comment on your caller. These are the very people that the McAuliffe campaign is trying to capture, right, to wake up Democrats in this off-year election. And so this is music. Ernest's call is music to their ears. They're hoping to get people like Ernest excited and engaged, even though we don't have a federal race in Virginia this year.
At the same time, I want to put this in some other polling numbers context. President Biden's poll numbers have been slipping. What impact, if any, do you think the intra-party fight over his domestic agenda has had on this race?
It definitely is weighing on the race, and Terry McAuliffe has talked about that. I think he didn't realize that he was on a public call a few weeks ago, and or a call that he was on with constituents or supporters were made public, where he said the quiet part out loud, and he worried about Biden's waning popularity and if it would have an impact on the race in Virginia. So it's certainly of concern to the campaign. And also the infighting among Democrats as well. To the extent that Democrats can get something accomplished in Washington, that only helps Terry McAuliffe. But the continued infighting, the lack of being able to deliver on a legislative victory for President Biden, that hurts McAuliffe and, you know, sort of displays inaction in Washington and makes it harder for McAuliffe to have issues to run on.
We got an email from Bill in Falls Church who says, I'm a Reagan Democrat, so haven't had many Democrats to vote for in many years. Unlike President Biden, I cannot support the radical pro-abortion moves. Otherwise, I think Virginia had a nice centrist balance that attracted a lot of good business activity. We'll have to see where that goes. And then Tina tweeted, Terry McAuliffe should be the next governor and his top priority should be helping working families. Now, in response to a prompt asking who should be the next governor of Virginia, Twitter user Brotege tweeted, Youngkin and his top priority should be getting Virginia fully open and making sure CRT is kept out of schools. Of course, CRT stands for critical race theory, and it has become an issue not just in this race, but around the nation, Jen.
Right. And we should be clear that critical race theory is not included in Virginia's school's curriculum. But we also got this email from Deb in Loudoun County who says, I plan on voting for Terry McAuliffe, but I do have concerns about the energy and momentum of his campaign. And Loudoun, the Republicans have hijacked our school board meetings and spread propaganda that is hateful against current board members. I believe in in public education, and I feel it is unfortunate that the school board has become so politicized, and I worry about what the future will bring. And Eva, school boards have become a touch point across the country for these larger political conflicts. How is that playing out in Virginia, especially in the governor's race?
Yeah, it's definitely a factor in this race. Glenn Youngkin is really running under the mantra of parents matter. He says it on every stop. And he's making the argument that in this time of COVID, parents have lost sort of their agency, and argues that the way that that race is talked about in schools, that parents should have more of input in that. And so it has become a real flashpoint in the campaign. In response, Terry McAuliffe often points to polls where he polls higher with parents than Youngkin, and often tries to steer the conversation back to education at large, and says, well, you know, listen, away from these sort of cultural arguments, I actually want to invest in education. But certainly this issue of parents and what their role should be in public school education is something that is of top of mind for voters on both sides.
Care to comment on that at all, Greg?
It's definitely where a lot of energy is in the race right now. And it's interesting because that is a national issue, too, that has crept into Virginia. But it's also interesting because Republicans, I think, clearly saw some potential in education-related issues all along. And earlier this year, they were sort of emphasizing the need to get schools open back up, and then schools opened, so that became sort of a non-issue, and they moved to critical race theory, and we've seen that kind of continue to play out into the fall.
Got to take a short break right now. We'll continue our conversation with Greg Snyder, Washington Post reporter covering Virginia, and Eva McKen, national politics reporter for CNN. I'm Kojo Namdi. Welcome back. I'm here with 1A host Jen White talking about the Virginia elections. Also joining us, Gregory Schneider, reporter for The Washington Post covering Virginia, and Eva McKen, a national politics reporter for CNN covering the Virginia governor's race.
We got a question from Richard in South Arlington who sent us this email. Glenn Youngkin has said that he was sad when Virginia expanded Medicaid, giving health care to hundreds of thousands of Virginians. Why was he sad? Could he try to scale back this expansion as governor? Greg, your response.
Well, that's been a big issue for years in Virginia. You know, Virginia resisted expanding Medicaid during McAuliffe's administration when he had a Republican legislature. But some Republicans joined with all Democrats to approve Medicaid expansion when Ralph Northam became governor. But it's still been a hot topic because of the sense that eventually you're creating an expectation that this will always be provided and the state's portion of paying for it is going to become greater in the future. So I think there, I don't know the mechanisms of it, but any of these changes that have happened under Democratic leadership over the past few years could be reversed, you know, if Republicans were to gain control of the executive mansion and the House of Delegates. And there's also a question of further expanding Medicaid. There's still several hundred thousand Virginians that, even with the way Medicaid has been expanded now, that still aren't eligible for health care. So Democrats want to keep pushing it forward and expand it to cover more people, and Republicans aren't so sure that's the right way to go about it. So that is something that could change if Youngkin were to be elected governor.
Here's Tom in Manassas, Virginia. Tom, your turn. Go ahead, please.
Hi, I'm an election officer. I'm also a convicted felon and had my rights restored. I'm a voting machine specialist now. I worked three elections so far. And what got me about Youngkin was he immediately came out with the election integrity issue. There is no issue about election integrity. So I started researching him, and I actually participated in his poll watcher training session the other day. And they're just trying to instill what Trump blatantly tried to instill, is doubt in the election process before the election even takes place. So I've got no time for Youngkin at all. He's just saying anything that he needs to say, and he doesn't mean a word of it.
Eva McCann, is there evidence that this is a trend around the country, this distrust of elections, particularly on the part of Republicans?
Well, absolutely, because former President Donald Trump has made it that way, right? He constantly talks about the 2020 election as being illegitimate and fraudulent. And so it's no surprise that so many Republicans across the country believe that is the case, even though it is not. Candidate Glenn Youngkin did focus on election integrity at the outset as one of the key issues in his campaign, but he hasn't really made that, I would say, the cornerstone at this point. He's since sort of distanced himself from that, and I would say he has made this issue of parental rights more of sort of the central focus and the issue that he is running on.
At the same time, Eva, there's a certain tension in this messaging from the former president. Last week, he had this message for donors to his Save America PAC. He wrote, quote, "If we don't solve the presidential election fraud of 2020, Republicans will not be voting in 22 or 24. It is the single most important thing for Republicans to do." So again, they're perpetuating the big lie once again that there was fraud during the 2020 election. And we're not to the midterms yet. But is that continued messaging having any impact on this race? How closely are Republican strategists watching that dynamic?
They are watching it very closely, and I think that they are concerned about this rhetoric coming from the former president. That doesn't necessarily inspire turnout. We saw that in the special election in Georgia earlier this year. So they are really concerned about that. And for his part, Glenn Youngkin is not really embracing that message at this stage. He wasn't even at the event last week where former President Trump called into that a conservative rally. He wants to be able to benefit from the former president sort of whipping up voters, and he wants to sort of embrace certain elements of Trumpism. But he is sort of keeping the former president somewhat at bay, I think, because of rhetoric like that. He doesn't want to do anything to depress any potential turnout that he may get.
Greg Schneider, he has the challenge Youngkin does, that is, on the one hand, trying to hold on to what is President Trump's base, and on the other hand, trying to win independent voters. How is he doing that, and do you think he's accomplishing it at this point?
It's a very, very tricky balancing act, and I think you saw over the course of the summer, he advertised heavily on television with commercials or spots that emphasized his background and that emphasized his success as a business executive and, you know, made him appear about as un-Trumpy as you could possibly appear, affable, like the guy next door you might borrow a lawnmower from. And I think he was trying very hard to put that image in Virginians' mind. But at the same time, he's got to keep that Trump base of the Republican Party energized, because those are the ones who unfailingly come out to vote and drive a lot of the energy at the root of the party. So that's the trick that has been hard for Republicans in Virginia for several years now. Ed Gillespie couldn't quite figure it out in 2017.
Well, so, go ahead.
Well, it's just that's clearly the thing he's got to solve. And it has mystified some analysts I've talked to, that even though Youngkin has distanced himself from some of those extreme statements, he's continued to kind of flirt with some of those issues that agitate the Republican base of the party. And he's had State Senator Amanda Chase, who styles herself as Trump in heels, and she's been out sort of acting as his surrogate in some events, especially in the central and southwestern part of the state. And he, you know, participated in an election integrity rally in Lynchburg over the summer. And so there has been, we'll find out when the election is done if he has struck the right balance on this stuff or not. But it has appeared to some that he's kind of acting as though he's not completely sure the base of the party is fired up and where it needs to be. And so he keeps kind of keeping the door open to some of these Trump-related issues.
You've added a new word to Jen and Maya's vocabulary, and that is un-Trumpy. I hadn't used that word before. Here is Judy in Virginia Beach. Judy, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yes, I have a number of reasons for the people I'm going to vote for and for going to the polls. The first one is anything that is not Trumpy would be someone that I would vote for, because I think he's done more to hurt America than any 10 other presidents put together. The second thing is that the House is important, and making sure that the federal House stays Democrat and that the state House stays Democrat, because it's really important that one of the things that's really important to me is if the commission, which is doing the commission that is trying to help with the
redistricting
size of the, yes, redistricting, thank you. If that fails, it goes back to the state house, and that's really important, so that it, hopefully we will have some reasonable and not such weird kinds of districts. And finally, climate control. I think it's really important because we have something on our local voting things to decide about spending a great amount of money and setting up loans to be able to pay for it and to do it now. And I think that's really important.
Okay, thank you very much for sharing your thoughts with us, Jen.
Well, here's a message we got from James in Arlington, who says, actually, let's do this one from Steve in Pocosin. He says, for America's sake, we Virginians must make this election a referendum on the Trump Party's methodical, remorseless campaign to undermine trust in elections, give partisans ballot counting power, intimidate election staff, perpetrate violence, and then cravenly project it onto all others. So that's one perspective. We also got this email from James in Arlington, who says, how effective in Virginia are the ads by the Democratic nominee where the Republican nominee is quoted saying he is honored by the backing of the former president? In other words, how are new voters and moderates in both parties as well as independents reacting? Greg, do we have a sense of that at this point?
Well, I think I've heard some anecdotal thoughts on that. And also, I think in our polling, the post poll that came out earlier this month sort of suggested that people are a little fatigued with the constant references to Donald Trump. And I think that there's, you know, that's a challenge on McAuliffe's side, is you have this guy in Youngkin who really doesn't look like Trump. Can I use the word un-Trumpy again? But he's trying to so hard to paint him that way. And it creates a little bit of a disconnect in voters' minds, and some people I've talked to are not certain that that's, you know, after some period of time of repeating it over and over and over, it loses its power. But what does seem to have some legs that we've seen in polling and also heard from Democratic strategists is reminding voters about Republican initiatives in other states, such as the Texas abortion law, or voting rights efforts in Georgia, or some of the coronavirus response in places like Florida and Texas, you know, the banning mask mandates or vaccine mandates and that kind of thing. And that, what I've been hearing lately, has become the bigger fad that Democrats think that might have more legs than this constant mentioning of Donald Trump. Although it's not slowing it down, you know, I think those ads are going to be with us until November 2nd would be my guess.
Here is Gary in Yorktown, Virginia. Gary, your turn.
Yes, hi. Yeah, I just a couple things. I think one of the guests there talked about where critical race theory is not in school. All teachers are required now to do cultural awareness training every other year. And that has tenets of what people would talk about critical race theory. The other thing is, don't be deceived that there is no critical race theory, as in CRT, that's going to be somewhere in a curriculum. There are tenets of it that are below, and it's really a broad a broad definition, but there is no, of course, there is no C. You're not going to see CRT because it's masked as other things. And also,
well, allow me to interrupt with a question. When you say it is masked as other things, a lot of people seem to feel that once you teach children in school about racism, once you teach children in school about slavery, once you teach children in school about how long those things have affected life in the United States, then in fact what you are teaching is critical race theory, which technically is an advanced graduate level topic. Do you feel that there is any place at all for teaching children in schools about the history of race and slavery in the United States?
Oh, absolutely. And it is taught. And I just know for a fact it's taught. And it is taught. But it's but when you have training that basically infer that the older systems were racist and so forth like that, that those are the types of tenets that people don't like to see. But it should all be taught and it should all be pointed out. But it should not be in a destructive manner. It should be in a historical context, which is accurate, not biased towards different agendas that people have.
Okay, thank you very much for your call. We got an email from Jim who says, I'm a Biden voter who's voting for Youngkin. CRT, critical race theory, is a joke, but people use it as a shorthand for the type of equity nonsense that is in our schools, such as watering down the Thomas Jefferson High School's admissions requirements, blathering on about white privilege, and seeing racism behind every problem. It's a disservice to simply write it off as some wide delusion when people use the shorthand. Eva McKen, to what extent is this a national trend that we're seeing?
Well, it absolutely is a national trend, and it is an issue that Glenn Youngkin has landed on. It is his loudest applause line when he mentions critical race theory at his rallies. He gets, screams and shouts and cheers because a lot of, from what I see, white Virginians in the audience at his rallies, mostly white Virginians, identify with this message. The big question now is if he is successful in this race, if he is elected Virginia's next governor, how much will we see an emphasis on how racial history and education is taught in public schools? This message, this strategy echoed in other races across the country. If he is successful, I would imagine we're going to see a lot more of a focus on this replicated all over the U.S.
We got this email from Susan who says it is really important to keep Virginia blue to keep moving forward. Over the last few years, we've made great progress with renewable energy. Virginia is going to be the national leader in solar and offshore wind, great for jobs and great movement for the climate. Greg, there's been a lot of focus on these sort of flashpoint issues that are conversations nationally. But how is something like climate change fitting into this race?
Well, it's interesting. It hasn't been discussed a lot that I've seen, to the dismay of some people, certainly on the left in the Democratic Party, who would like to see it a bigger issue. There were, I think on Friday night when Jill Biden came down to the Richmond area to campaign with Terry McAuliffe, there were protesters, anti-natural gas pipeline protesters that briefly interrupted the event. Because it's something that people care about, and over the past few years, as these gas pipelines have been proposed or begun in Virginia, it's actually united some conservatives and liberals who, for different reasons, who oppose the taking of land or the destruction of habitats. So it is a little surprising to me. McAuliffe has tried to bring it up a lot by talking about the jobs that are potential in this turn to alternative forms of energy. You know, there's a big wind farm going up off the coast of Virginia Beach, and there's been a push to try to get some business in building the components of those giant windmills around the ports there in Norfolk and Portsmouth to try to make that more of a homegrown industry. But, you know, you've also heard on the Republican side some pushback to the idea that the legislature has passed over the last year or two that Virginia is going to transition to a carbon-free footprint over the next 20, 30 years. It's a little amusing about that is that Dominion Energy, the biggest utility in the state, was actually part of writing the bill that charted out the time frame for the transition away from the coal-fired power plants and that kind of thing. So it's a little bit of a muddled issue, and it hasn't been as prominent in this campaign as you might have expected it to be.
Well, we got an email from Susan who said, it's really important to keep Virginia blue to keep moving forward. Over the last few years, we've made great progress with renewable energy. Virginia is going to be the national leader in solar and offshore wind. Great for jobs and great movement for the climate. So that's another opinion. We'd love to hear yours. With Jen White, host of 1A, I'm Kojo Namdi. Kojo Namdi here. Welcome back. I'm here with 1A host Jen White talking about the Virginia elections. It's your turn, but first, here's Jen.
We got this email from Lewis in Charlottesville who says, I'm not affiliated with any political party, but I plan to vote for Terry McAuliffe simply because I feel like there's no other choice. I'm frustrated that the Democratic Party couldn't come up with a better candidate than McAuliffe, who I feel has nothing to recommend him other than his opponent's embrace of Trump. Eva, talk about what's happening on both sides right now for Democrats and Republicans. How are they trying to stir up enthusiasm for the people they need to get to the polls so they can win this very tight race?
Well, Terry McAuliffe is characterizing Glenn Youngkin as basically another Trump replicate. That is how he hopes to inspire turnout among Democrats through just generating that fear. Because when you do mention Trump, a lot of Democrats are very turned off by that. But in the same token, it could backfire because hearing that Glenn Youngkin is dressed just like Trump is very attractive to many Virginia Republicans. We've also seen Terry McAuliffe embrace having big name Democrats stump on his behalf. I was at a Stacey Abrams rally yesterday, and lots of enthusiasm there. And Kamala Harris will return, President Biden as well, Barack Obama on Saturday. And so that's a way he's also trying to gin up enthusiasm. Whereas Glenn Youngkin, he is kind of just, he's running this race by not embracing national Republicans at all. He said that he doesn't need sort of these national surrogates, that he is enough of a draw, and that him alone can inspire turnout and get people to come out to his events. So those are sort of the differing strategies that the campaigns are employing.
Greg Schneider, you were at the event with Stacey Abrams, and it is clear that what the McAuliffe campaign is trying to do is to raise the level of enthusiasm among Democrats in general and black Democrats in particular. It's my understanding that he and Stacey Abrams hit about 7 churches yesterday. Obviously, they didn't go to many Baptist churches, otherwise they'd still be there. But that's a whole nother story. But are you seeing that kind of enthusiasm they're bringing in? As has been mentioned earlier, they're bringing in President Obama, and Vice President Kamala Harris has sent messages to a lot of black churches in Virginia. Do you see any response, any kind of enthusiastic response to that?
Well, yes. And I've spent a Sunday going to black churches in Norfolk and Chesapeake with Terry McAuliffe a couple weeks back. And those are very enthusiastic crowds and very engaged crowds, many of whom said they had already voted or certainly planned to vote. There were people yesterday down in Norfolk who'd been at church in the morning and were planning to go vote that day, because this is the first year that Virginia's offered early voting on Sundays. But I've talked to some other groups that do canvassing. You know, they go out knocking on doors, trying to remind people about the upcoming election, and who do that in predominantly black neighborhoods and find a little bit of fatigue out there. You know, not just because we've gone through 4 years of a Donald Trump administration that many, certainly Democrats, but many black Virginians found, you know, tiring. But, you know, the coronavirus, too. We've had that. We've had economic problems, and it's always something, one crisis after another, one of them said to me. So there's concern that if Democrats let their guard down, and if black Democrats in particular don't turn out in big numbers like they have over the past 4 years or so, then this could slip away from Terry McAuliffe, and also from, you know, in those House of Delegates races. The Democrats have a 55 to 45 seat edge over Republicans right now. And Kojo, you talked earlier about it being a blue wave, but the truth is the little components of that wave, some of them have been very narrow victories for Democrats that could easily tilt back the other way in some of these districts or some of these House races. There was a House race in Virginia Beach that a Democrat won by 40 votes last time. And so you can bet that one is being contested very vigorously this time. So that question of enthusiasm and the question of whether Black voters will turn out in these, you know, elevated numbers is a big one, is the big one for Democrats this year.
Here is Susan in Alexandria. Susan, your turn.
Hi, thank you. I just want to remind people that running a state is a really hard job, and you need somebody who has some experience. We just got finished with a president who had no experience in running anything politically and no interest in it. Now, McAuliffe was governor before, and Virginia was very well recognized as a well-run state. People may forget that. Whereas you look at McAuliffe, at McAuliffe, and you've got a guy who knows what he's doing. You look at Youngkin, and you got a guy who has no experience whatsoever except in being a...
You seem to be questioning the wisdom of Virginia's system of having one-term governors. You seem to be advocating that governors get better experience after one term, so they should stick around for two. Is that what you're suggesting?
Well, sometimes. At least it would give the public a chance, a referendum on whether they want to return that person to office or extend them for another, just as we do with the presidents.
All right, you're going to have to change the law in Virginia to get there, though. But here's Jen.
We got this email from Lisa from Burke, who says, I am a lifelong Republican who voted Democrat for the first time in 2016. Not because I feared Trump. I merely thought he was not qualified for the job. Unfortunately, he exceeded my expectations. My greatest fear is that all Republicans, including Youngkin, would rather be under increasing pressure to emulate Trump. My second greatest fear about Youngkin is that he will be under pressure to align Virginia's COVID policies with states like Texas and Florida. And Eva, we can't ignore the fact that this election is happening against the backdrop of a continuing pandemic. How have each of the candidates placed that issue in their campaigns?
Well, Terry McAuliffe really wants to make it front and center because he thinks he has the winning argument here. They do have different approaches. Terry McAuliffe supports vaccine mandates. Glenn Youngkin does not. He says that he got vaccinated and he encourages everyone to do so if they choose to do so, but would not mandate it. If we get to a position where vaccines are safe for children under 12, and that is the guidance that comes from the CDC, Tara McAuliffe thinks that kids should be required to take the vaccine if the health professionals say that it is safe for them to do so. Whereas Glenn Youngkin doesn't believe in mandates at all. And so there are key differences there. And Terry McAuliffe really sees most Virginians as sort of aligned with his viewpoint more so than Glenn Youngkin's, and why he has made it really a staple of his campaign argument. Whereas Glenn Youngkin really, really has not. You don't see him at most of his events sort of leading with talking about the coronavirus, where you see McAuliffe doing so.
We also got this email from Liz in Blacksburg, who says, I very much want to see Princess Blanding as the next governor of Virginia, but with the close election, I had to vote for McAuliffe. I really like Blanding's emphasis on addressing climate change, racial equity, and work on mental health issues. Eva, explain this extra context here and how it fits into the race.
Yeah, Princess Blanding is running as part of the newly formed Liberation Party. She's a third party candidate. She believes that Democrats or people who who are progressive should not have to choose between what she characterizes as the less of two evils in Terry McAuliffe. She's very vocal and very disappointed that she wasn't allowed to participate in all of the events, the second debate. She really wanted to be up on that stage, and actually she came forward and spoke out during the debate that she should be up there on that stage with them. Her brother was killed by police, a very devastating episode. And so she really understands, you know, police reform is not just a political issue for her. It's a personal issue. And she wishes that that issue was really at the forefront, criminal justice reform, police reform. I will say that those issues, I don't think, have really arisen to the top here in this race. But that actually Glenn Youngkin and Terry McAuliffe are actually very similar in their positions on police. I think Glenn Youngkin has tried to argue that Terry McAuliffe disrespects law enforcement, but, you know, they both support keeping qualified immunity. And, you know, that was something that Terry McAuliffe didn't said that he wanted to end qualified immunity when he was running in the Democratic primary, but he has since changed his position. So I would say the two of them are pretty similar on issues when it comes to law enforcement.
Here now is Andrew in Arlington, Virginia. Andrew, your turn.
Hi, yes. I'm a generally Democratic voter on the progressive end of the party. I voted for Joe Biden in 2020 with the Vote Blue No Matter Who moniker, and I will not be voting for Terry McAuliffe this election. I think national-level Democrats and even local Democrats have shown quite a bit of disdain for progressive policies and progressive candidates across the country since 2020. And so I'll be sitting this out. As much as I don't want to see Glenn Youngkin win, I don't think Terry McAuliffe and other national-level Democrats have earned our vote.
Greg Snyder, to what extent have you observed that as a tendency among some progressive Democrats in Virginia in this election cycle?
Well, I can't say I've observed it a lot, but I've observed the fear of that. And that's another unanswered question is whether Princess Blanding will attract enough of voters with that kind of sentiment to cut into Terry McAuliffe's vote total. You know, either people won't vote at all, as the caller mentioned, or they'll vote for Princess Blanding as someone who carries forward more of that what they would call the progressive agenda. And that's a risk for McAuliffe for sure, just as Youngkin has to balance, you know, not alienating the Trump base and not alienating the suburban moderates. McAuliffe has to keep the more liberal wing of the party motivated to come out and vote, because that's where the energy is. That's, a lot of young people. That's kind of the future of the party, and he's got to get them out there. The people I've talked to the past few days from some of the left-leaning independent groups that are working out there knocking on doors think that, you know, if they do their job right, people realize how much is at stake, and they'll come out and essentially hold their nose and vote anyway. But that's another big mystery that's going to be solved here in 2 weeks.
Well, we got this message from Renee in Falls Church, who says, I'm voting for Terry McAuliffe because I don't want the newly instated marijuana laws to change. We also got this email from John, who says, how are the two campaigns doing in energizing members of the Latino communities? Eva, what can you tell us?
Yeah, both of them have really made a concerted effort to go after this constituency, holding events specifically for Latinos. So they understand the importance of that vote. They have seen Republicans able to make, or Glenn Youngkin's campaign has seen Republicans able to make significant inroads with Latinos in recent years, and wants to take advantage of that momentum.
And Greg, has the marijuana issue, has it come up significantly in this election campaign?
No, I wouldn't say that it has. In fact, that also had some bipartisan support in the legislature. I think even beyond the actual vote totals that we wound up with, there were Republicans who favored that bill who might not have voted for it just because of some particulars in it. But I haven't really heard that come up much at all on the campaign. So I feel like that's probably a sea change that's happened, and Virginia's moving forward.
Here is Katie in Annandale. Katie, your turn.
Hi, thank you. I am excited to vote. I always vote. I'm excited to vote. But I am more motivated this time because of everything that is happening in Texas. I think that when the Supreme, not when, not if, the Supreme Court overturns Roe in the coming year, it's going to come to the states. And so I am trying to motivate all my other similarly inclined friends and family who might sit out an off-year election, and maybe even motivate Andrew, previous caller, who I think could think about the women and folks in his life that may be greatly affected if we have a Republican head in Virginia. I mean, Terry McAuliffe stood in the way of a lot of anti-choice legislation when he was governor, and I think he would do it again. So that's a pretty big motivation for me.
Eva McCann, have you been following that in Virginia?
Yes, and that is what I'm hearing on the ground. When you speak to Democratic voters, they're saying that even if, you know, Terry McAuliffe has been around a long time and sort of is part of the Democratic establishment, they might not necessarily all be necessarily be excited about him as an individual, as a candidate, but they are attracted to this idea that he could be a block against any type of chipping away at reproductive choice. I mean, I spoke to a woman just yesterday who told me this very same thing that your caller did, that she's very concerned about the future of abortion rights in this country, and that if it does come down to the states, they want a governor at the state level who is going to be able to protect their right to choose as much as possible.
Greg Snyder, new campaign finance reports came out over the weekend. Where do the two campaigns stand in terms of fundraising? We only have about 2 minutes left.
They're in record territory, Kojo. They're raising more money than has ever been raised in a Virginia governor's race. Combined total of about $88 million and still counting. We could hit $100 million. McAuliffe is so far leading Youngkin. And Youngkin, you know, has this ability theoretically to self-fund. He's put, $14 million of his own dollars into the race so far, and theoretically could put much more than that. There's one more reporting period before November 2nd at the end of October, and we'll see. For September, Youngkin did not put in any more of his own money, but it's big, big numbers.
Eva, briefly, the governor's race is what we've been focusing on for most of the hour, and it's definitely in the national spotlight. But how closely are the down ballot races being watched by the White House and political strategists across the country?
I haven't heard the White House emphasize those as much. But when you do speak to organizers, progressive organizers on the ground in Virginia, it's something that they are concerned about, because they tell me even if Terry McAuliffe is able to pull out a win, and Glenn Youngkin doesn't achieve an upset in Virginia, they still feel as though they're going to have to put a lot of pressure on McAuliffe to get their progressive policy priorities over the finish line. And so they view those down-ballot races as really important to achieving that.
That's about all the time we have, except for this brief reprimand for you, Greg, and maybe for me. We got an email from Sigrid who said, "I'm mortified when I hear what is being said on your show today as people start using the word un-Trumpy. My name is Sigrid Trumpy. I'm a Democrat and 100% opposed to Trump and everything that he stands for." And that's about all the time we have. Gregory Schneider is a reporter for The Washington Post covering Virginia. Gregory, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks. I enjoyed it.
And Eva McCann is a national politics reporter for CNN. Eva, thanks for being here.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
And our thanks to all those who called in. This show was made possible by the producers at WAMU and NPR. Our engineer is Mike Kidd, and our phone screener, Kayla Hewitt. Thanks for listening and stay safe. I'm Jen White.
And I'm Kojo Namdi from WAMU in Washington.